You're listening to Cards to the Moon, a podcast about trading cards from both a collector and investor perspective. We hope you'll stick around for the ride as we take a deep dive into the state of the hobby, share some hot takes, hopefully some useful advice and fun stories along the way. Hey guys, welcome back to Cards to the Moon. This is episode 203. My name is Clark from 5cardguys.com and 5cardguys on Instagram. With me co-hosting, as usual, is John, who is Trade You at Recess. Hyung is actually away for the next couple of episodes, but in his place, we have our good friend Will back again. Most of this episode is actually going to be from a podcast I was on as a guest about a month and a half ago. It's called Gambling with Good Juju, right? They focus more on different types of gambling, as the title suggests, but there are obvious crossovers between, you know, the world of sports betting and sports card collecting, especially when it comes to the breaking side of things, which we talked on the pod. But also in that pod, we talked about the sports card industry overall and where it all seems to be heading, in my opinion. So definitely stay tuned for that at the end of this episode. But off the top, back to the guys here. I want to talk about the Connor Bedard Young Guns rookie card. All right. We saw the initial hype as expected with the release of Upper Deck Series 2 a couple of weeks ago. And even the base Young Guns rookie card was going for a pretty penny, if you guys remember. Now, since then, we've seen some of the Young Guns base rookie cards graded by PSA. And just to give you some recent comps, the first PSA 10 card sold for just over $3,600 less than a month ago on March 13. All right. And as of yesterday, April 3rd, it sold for $1,432. So that's less than half the first sale. So my question is, do you think the PSA 10 Young Guns stabilizes here of Connor Bedard, or does it have more room to go down? What do you guys think? And, by the way, pop count right now, if you're curious, for a PSA 10 is 233.
Wow. So I think I should respond first because John will give the right answer. Okay. Because he's the hockey expert and I...
That's wise.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. But I did want to come prepared because, you know, I find that when I do this podcast, if I want to do a good job, preparation is key, especially when it comes to hockey. So I went on Card Ladder. I looked at the hockey index. I looked at Young Guns cards from the year 2000 and on, PSA 10. What were the highest valued cards? And so it's like Ovechkin at 3,500, Connor McDavid 2,700, Sidney Crosby 2,600, Patrice Bergeron 1,660, and then Connor Bedard at a value of 1,400, and then Austin Matthews at like 1,250, and then Pasternak at 1,095. So that's kind of like the top cards from that index of Young Guns from the year 2000. And I thought to myself, okay, where does Connor Bedard fit on that list of players? If Austin Matthews is at 1250, and I heard rumblings that we think that Austin Matthews could end up being the all-time goal scorer. Is that true?
Ooh.
Like, there's a chance.
Hot take, but if he, I mean, that's two straight, or not too straight, but he's got two 60 goal seasons already. So
the funny thing is,
he's got to keep a pretty darn good pace.
I know so little about hockey that I didn't even know that was a hot take. I just heard it somewhere that he had a chance. So if Austin Matthews is right around that 1250 range, and actually, he's got like a lot of pop on that card. It's like a pop 3450, which is a lot. Wow. I would assume Connor Bedard's going to be like pretty high as well for his PSA 10s. So I think somewhere in that range is good, like around that 1250, just because there's so much hype behind him and who knows what'll happen. So.
Wow, I like that.
Well done, I did my research.
Well done.
I did my homework. You know, the Sport Card Expo is coming later this month. I might be on the hunt for real.
Yeah, I can't wait for that either.
Oh, yeah.
But that was well
done.
There
you go. I did some homework. Well thank done, you. William. Thank you, hockey fans.
Yeah.
Yes.
So to summarize, the 1450 mark. So you think it has room to go down a little bit more based on all the other comps of the other players. So maybe a couple hundred more.
I think so. I think that's where it should settle.
Okay. Yeah, Johnny, what's the right answer?
Listen, you guys are doing a disservice to the listeners by calling me the hockey expert. I am far from that, but I think Will is pretty. I mean, I was about to say the same thing. He's pretty spot on. Because I mean, for me, I look at the talent and the hype, and like I said before, I'm still not quite convinced that Bedard is on the McDavid. He's pretty darn close though, man. Like for him to be on such a crappy team with not so great line rates as a little, he's like a kid and he's still putting up points left, right, and center. He's still doing his thing. That's a sign of a A++ superstar slash generational player. If somebody said to me, I think Connor Bedard is a generational player, I wouldn't, you know, I'm not quite there yet, but I wouldn't be like, you're an idiot. Like I think that, you know, that makes sense. So if we're putting Bedard, I mean, for me personally, I kind of put him right. I put him below McDavid, and Matthews is hyped right now. So his price has ballooned a bit, right? So you have to imagine a cooled down Austin Matthews is like $900, $1,000. I would put it somewhere between McDavid, probably closer to the Matthews side, is Will spot on. So I think probably has some more to go down, but I would assume his hype is still going to be huge heading into next season. I mean, this is the biggest chase in hockey that hockey has seen in a while. So I think even the following season next year, you know, people are still going to be going after Bedard. His Future Watch auto is going to come out. So I think it's still going to stay hot and probably settle in the sort of $1,000 to $1,250, $1,300 range. I think that's a good, I mean, right now the pop is coming up quick, like already 200. How long, what's the release been? Like 3 weeks or a month or something
around
like that?
There.
That's,
yeah.
That's fast. But at the same time, I'm sure buyers are, as much as they want to buy as much as they want to buy Bedard, everyone is weary that this thing's going to come down to earth. So I think there's just such a influx of PSA 10s hitting the market right now that the demand is not catching them. And that's what you're seeing. So I think we're about to see the price settle a bit. 14, 13, 12, somewhere around there is my guess. I think Will nailed it.
Well, there you go. Yeah, the latest sell as of this recording, April 4th, it just hit $1,349. So creeping downward.
Right.
Even from... even when I was preparing the notes, it went from $1,450 to $1,350. So if that trend continues, I feel like for me, it's all about the pop count. Do we think that the young guns of Bedard, there's just as many as in the previous sets? Or do you think they curb that population? Like I have no idea. It's not Product's best interest to print as many as possible, I guess, yes. In terms of profit, right? So I could see that the pop count could just be as high at the end of the day, you know, when things settle down in terms of the submissions. But yeah, I don't know. I think it could go under 1,000 at some point. That's you know.
Yeah, especially off season.
In the off season. Yeah, 100%. Right. And I had a lunch with a friend today, and he puts Bedard under Matthews in terms of talent. So that's the case. Yeah. So I don't know how hot of a hot take that is either, but if that's the case, then yeah, for sure. Probably 900 maybe. So plus, you know, there's other parallels too, like more parallels for the set as well.
Right.
Maybe that's what gets the price bump and the base ones just kind of come down further than, you know, Austin Matthews and other players.
I ripped a couple of packs of, Series 2, and the quality control, I didn't watch any breaks. I don't know if you guys watch breaks for Upper Deck. Quality control seems great. Like all the cards
okay.
are cut nicely. You know, like this is not the Lafreniere year where like the cards were in brutal condition coming out of packs. So that that could also inflate the PSA 10 numbers. You might be seeing a lot in terms of gem rate.
Mm, good point. All right, we'll see what happens, especially, you know, just as we said, when it's in the off season, it'll be interesting to see the price action then, because we know the Blackhawks definitely aren't going to make the playoffs. So that might be a good time to buy if you're looking for one.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, let's just play that interview now from the Gambling with Good Juju podcast. Hope you guys enjoy it, and we'll see you again on Tuesday for a brand new episode.
All right, we're not gonna let's ride today, gentlemen. That's because we talked with Clark from Five Card Guys. See, I did it. I almost said Five Guys there. We talked with Clark of Five Card Guys, and he was awesome. And we had so many questions. You guys got to bear with us a little bit, audience. We kind of were almost jumping over each other, but it was a very fun conversation. We learned so much. We wanted to know about what's going on here, because I have kids who are starting to enter into this hobby, and I remember it from the era growing up in the late 90s of, yeah, it turns out none of those were worth anything, so don't even bother. And it turns out there's a lot more, and it's still a thriving hobby. And you know, we had heard the national news and all that stuff in the pandemic era. And Kurt was very into trading cards. Were you always into trading cards, by the way, or did you take a break and come back to it in the pandemic?
I took a break and came back.
Yeah. When did you come back to it? In the pandemic or before?
A little before.
Yeah. So you were at least familiarized with the market when that hit to kind of take advantage of it some?
Yeah.
Okay. Because yeah. Clark was the same way. He came into the hobby a couple years before, and he's going to get into how they got into it and all that good stuff. But I just find it fascinating to get the mind of someone who's in a industry that's so closely tied to the sports gambling world where we live. And even during the course of that conversation, we had some back and forth where it's like, oh man, I have a perfect analogy to this in sports gambling, or that story is actually bleeding into sports gambling itself, as we were talking about. So
Shadow Fanatics.
I don't know, Juice, what'd you think?
I love the conversation. I learned a lot. It was really interesting to talk to somebody so deep into the hobby and the social aspect of the hobby, I guess.
Yeah, and that's the fun part about it is if you think of it through the prism that we kind of do in sports gambling where, yeah, you'd like to make money on this hobby.
Sure.
But the making the money on the hobby also funds the hobby itself.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. So they're doing the same thing by investing in trading cards. And it's a fascinating world. And it sounds like it's something that I'm going to want to learn more about.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially since you have kids.
Yeah. Did you feel that even as someone who was already pretty well informed on that market, that you took away some learnings on top of that, Kurt?
Yeah, I'm just glad I got updated on what's going on, because I've kind of dropped out a little bit since sports gambling's just taken over my entire life, basically. So I've kind of been a little bit out of the loop. So I'm glad I got to talk to him and kind of get updated on everything that's going on in the industry.
Cool. Yeah.
Awesome.
Roll the tape.
Yeah, we're going to let it go. We're going to let you guys hear less of us and more of him. So stay tuned for that, and we'll talk again next week. Good juju your bets, folks. Peace out.
Good night.
We welcome into the show Clark from Five Card Guys. I say that Five Guys cards every time in my head, and every time it makes me hungry, Clark. Clark and his friends have a variety of ways to keep people engaged and entertained within the world of trading cards. They feature daily auctions and fun anecdotes on their Instagram page, at Five Card Guys. Their podcast, Cards to the Moon, takes a deep dive into the state of the hobby, shares some hot takes, and provides useful advice and fun stories along the way. You can find links to all their content via their website, fivecardguys.com. Clark, welcome to the show, bud. How's it going?
Good gig. Glad to be here. I think this will be fun.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. We've Absolutely. Done this conversation a lot between the three of us, and we know there are a lot of folks out there in the sports gambling space who are interested in trading cards and understanding memorabilia a little bit better. So bear with us during this conversation, as I'm fairly a noob. As we had discussed before the show, I have the exact same background that 90% of 40-year-old males have, which is I collected in the 90s. It didn't seem to go very well, and I went away from it, and I didn't really come back to it until I had small children, right. and they are interested in it, and so now I find myself coming back to it. Kurt, on the other hand, over here has been a hobbyist and a collector himself for quite some time, so throughout the course of this interview, we're going to mix in some conversations more on the expert side of things and more of the fun things, but before we get into all that, let's start here. What made you decide to start Five Card Guys?
It's funny because your story that you just shared is exactly what happened to me. Collected in the 90s. you know, we got out of it, you know, like we got other interests growing up in high school and university. And then right before the pandemic, I just happened to read a blog about sports cards, like just happenstance. And then, you know, nostalgia hit, right? You remember the kid card collecting days. And then you kind of do research and, you know, I'm also in my mid-40s now. I have two young kids as well. And we have a little more disposable income than we did when we were 7 and 8 years old, right? so you go back to the card shops, wherever they are, and you start to kind of go down memory lane. And then you go down this rabbit hole, which we'll talk about. Like when you go start researching about where the state of the hobby is right now, it's crazy. Like there's a lot more people coming into the space. And especially during the pandemic, it really blew up. But going back to your original question, I started the blog with four other guys, four of my friends, hence the name Five Card Guys. And actually, one of the guys thought it was funny because it does sound like five guys, which we love. And everyone that we talk to says the exact same thing. So, you know, it's a good way to remember our website name because it's so closely affiliated to Five Guys Burgers.
I had to retype the name of your guys's brand several times because I kept getting them backwards.
I don't blame you. You know, a lot of people do the same thing. But yeah, there was five of us, and then we just got into it. We're like, hey, remember when we collected cards? And then we started to buy some boxes. You know, kind of split boxes, and then we started ripping packs, and that's how we got into it. But that was like a couple years before pandemic hit. And then when the pandemic hit, everything just blew up. You know, like people were bored at home and they're just spending all their disposable income on buying baseball cards and football cards and basketball cards. And yeah, just from there, we went from a blog to I've met a couple other friends who are currently my co-hosts of the Cards to the Moon podcast. And, you know, we just happened to learn, hey, you're collecting cards too? And then we had this like WhatsApp chat group between like, there's about 10 of us now in this chat group. We always talk cards throughout the day. And the three of us, we always talk cards anyways. And we're like, hey, might as well kind of record what we're talking about, you know, because we talk about cards anyways, just like the three of you guys
right.
talking about sports gambling. It just comes naturally. We're like, oh, might as well record. I'm sure someone wants to hear us talk about sports cards. And four seasons later, we're in year four now. And I think we have about a couple of thousand subscribers just coming on weekly for our podcast. So it's been a fun ride, but that's kind of the slow evolution over the last 6-7 years of our site.
Did you start the podcast portion of that before or after the pandemic?
It started pretty much right in the pandemic, 4 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the timing behind that had to have been fairly well related to the hobby, correct? If starting at a couple of years before the pandemic, isn't that when there was just a massive explosion in interest?
Just before, yeah. When the website was happening, you know, I didn't know how big the hobby was. Definitely not as big when the pandemic hit, because then, you know, a lot of people got into space. Corporations, you know, just started throwing money into the hobby. All these huge auction houses have been formed in the last 3-4 years. And then, yeah, just a lot of money. And Fanatics, we could talk about that later. You know, they're buying pretty much every sports card company out there, consolidating everything. But yeah, right before it wasn't as big until the pandemic hit. And then when it did, it just was, you could sense that everyone was on eBay buying cards on their spare time.
So give me a quick sense here. Do you find investing in cards purely an entertainment hobby? Or is there genuine gains to be made through investing in the hobby?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think in the last 3 years and 3 to 4 years, like things have definitely changed in how you invest in the hobby. Because when it was booming, you could pretty much buy anything, buy boxes, rip packs open, you send it to graders, you know, like the different, there's different grading companies. And then when you get the grade back, you could pretty much flip them for, you know, sometimes 5, 6, 7, 10x the initial raw card value. But now that the market's kind of really corrected itself, now that this is like kind of the post hobby boom, people are losing their shirts. If you went in during 2021, you went at the peak. So now we're at 2024. Everything's kind of, some cards have dropped probably more than 60-70% of its peak value, you know, and, you know, it was kind of, the writing was on the wall, you know, everything was very overinflated. But I still think that, and we talk about this on our podcast too, right? Like now that everything's kind of settled down, it's kind of the buying opportunity for some of those bigger cards, like those grail cards. You know, I just bought a Luka Doncic, if you're into basketball, his rookie autograph card that's numbered to 99. And at the peak, it sold for about $30,000. Wow. And I bought it for about $6,500 just a few months ago. So I do think there's a play, you know, everything that's kind of like stocks and, sure. And in a way, you know, you buy things when they're cheaper, preferably, and then you wait till things go back up, hopefully.
Do you target specific sports or you, yeah, let's, whatever there's value in, I'm chasing it?
I particularly like to chase baseball and basketball because that's the sports I know the best. Yeah. So, and you know, football's, I know a lot of my friends collect football, especially in the States. You know, we're a Canadian podcast, but a lot of our listeners, most of our listeners actually are in the States. And I know football is a big, big thing south of the border. So a lot of football card collectors. But, you know, each sport has its kind of trends, right? Like yeah, in football, sure. You go for the quarterbacks, right? There's not a lot of value in running backs or wide receivers. Baseball, you like to go for the home run hitters. Basketball, guys to score lots of points, you know, so... But for me, I like to stick with baseball, basketball primarily. Baseball is my first love, so I usually go for baseball. And I know off the air we were talking about some certain prospects. Love prospecting; it's a gamble. That's a, if you want to talk about gambling, that's the biggest gamble in sports card. When you're prospecting,
So you actually made mention to this, and yeah. I find it particularly interesting as one of the main areas my son and I have found entertainment through this is if you're collecting a player prospect in Major League Baseball, and let's say you get an autograph of them. I'll give you an example. He picked Nathan Maritola. I don't know.
Don't look at me.
San Diego Padres hitting prospect.
Oh, yeah.
He pulls a Bowman Chrome autograph, pink foil, one of 199 of them. And, yep. You know, you go look and see if this has any value and you see, okay, maybe it's worth $3 or something like that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But you have then the opportunity to follow this person's career. And
yes.
Throughout the course of him building through the minors and the majors, if he does explode, if he becomes a utility player, that's a guy you've got an investment in now, almost like you own a part of his career. Mm-hmm. Is that how you guys look at it? Is that one of the more popular ways that you see people engaging in the hobby itself?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, there's a debate in the hobby where are you mostly a collector or are you mostly an investor, right? And in reality, most people are both. And, you know, like, from the collector side, that's where the, you know, going for your favorite player or someone you like to root for, you know, throughout their career. That's where it makes things fun. But on the investor side of things, you hope that they do really well because then their card values will obviously increase over time. So there's kind of both coming into play. And if you can find a player that kind of, you know, can, you know, you like them as a player and also they're a good prospect, so that would be a good investment. You kind of want to find those players that can satisfy both criteria, right? But for some, it's like, short-term prospect flip. So maybe I don't care that much about a certain player because they're not from the Toronto Blue Jays, for example, but I know that they're like a top 10 prospect. And once they get called up, usually there's a spike in value. Mm. At that time, I'm going to try to sell. So I have no really emotional attachment to the player, but I'm doing that for investment purpose. Short-term flip in that case. Yeah.
Do you do research on prospects, for example, to evaluate whether or not investing in a player is a viable move in the same way we might invest in a wager.
Like, what's the percentage this guy's going to get called?
Yeah. Like, would you look at prospects and go, I see a potential in this particular project prospect, so I'm going to target them for that reason?
Oh, yeah. For me, I do. Yeah. Like, yeah. And the prospecting game is so much fun that way, because you're like, you're pretty much looking at 16, 17, 18 year olds, right? That are young kids. And then, you know, for them to go through the farm system, you look at the scouting reports, you know, you look at Keith Laws, you know, in the Athletic, his top 50 MLB prospects, and then you just kind of go through the list. But the thing is, for every prospect, you know, it's a risk, right? Like, it's, you know, some guys come up as a top five prospect and they do absolutely nothing when they hit the MLB, you know? And other guys, they come up as like 25th prospect on the list and they start mashing. And then, so it's kind of like one of those things, like, that's the game I like to play. I never look at the top 10, because in reality, when you go look for the first Bowman Chrome, like you were just mentioning, their first Bowman Chrome autograph is the card you want for top MLB prospects. But the top 10, the price is usually baked in already.
Right.
So when you know, even as an 18-year-old, you're looking at probably spending a few $100s just for the rookie auto cards. If you look beyond the top 10, it gets riskier, obviously, because you don't know if they're going to, you know, really do well. But right. Their cards are so much more affordable, you know, cheaper. And then you can hope that if they do well, then they easily 2-3x when they get called up to the show. Yeah.
I like you said, the price is baked in. Like, how often do we say that when we're gambling?
You say that all the time.
Right.
Can you give us a brief overview on the different types of collectors there are? Because I've listened to a couple of your shows, and I think you've made mention to, I think you just meant like a collector versus an investor. Mm-hmm. What are the groups of individuals that you would consider collectors or whatever it is?
Yeah. Another good question. Like, for some people, there's so many different ways to collect, right? So usually rookie cards have the most value in general. Like, for myself, I generally only like to collect rookie cards. You know, and you know, maybe some veteran players of like the Blue Jays or my hometown team. All right. So that's mostly for my PC, my personal collection. So you got people that collect that way. And there's people that just purely collect PC stuff. I grew up in Sacramento. I'm only going to collect Sacramento Kings players. I don't care who it is. That's the guy. You know, we interview guests on our show as well. And it's, I can't remember the guy's name, the basketball player. It's like obscure basketball player, but he's the guy that collects just that player, and he knows that no one else is going to collect him because he's so like, he's like a bench guy, you know. So people like to collect that way. Others like to go for, like, if you know, there's a guy named Shine150, his Instagram handle is Shine150. He's the one that owns the $4.3 million Luka Doncic rookie National Treasures. So he collects super high end, you know, and there's high end products. You got collectors like that. All depends on your budget, of course, right? Sure. So high-end collectors, rookie card collectors, PC collectors. So yeah, that's just a few of the big ones in terms of if you want to categorize some of these collectors, for sure.
Product collectors too, wax collectors.
Oh, good one. Yes.
Like, yeah. Unopened stuff?
Like the stuff I have in my drawers. Yeah.
But that's what you mean by, we say, yeah, wax, like unopened?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most people
it's like sealed still?
Yep.
Okay. So that's like we would say that's like a mutual fund. You just hope that, you know, the you know, over time it'll carry value, because you don't know whoever the rookie is in that sealed product. Maybe it's, you find out 10 years later that's a particularly strong rookie class, and then that box, that sealed box, becomes really valuable, because you could, you know, for some people they might want to take the risk of buying that box 10 years down the road, hoping that they can actually open the box then and hit some of these rookies,
right,
in that class, right? So yeah, it's a play for sure.
I see multiple people open like the box of Fleer Jordan rookie on the internet before, and it's like, how are these still floating around even?
that's because people like me who
put them in the drawer,
put them in their drawers, and yeah, then they leave them alone for 30 years, and then all of a sudden they're worth $100,000,
right?
Probably more than that. I mean, that 86 Fleer sealed wax has probably got to go for what?
Yeah,
150 grand, I would imagine, somewhere in that ballpark.
All because of a guy named Michael Jordan. Yeah,
right. Because he's the best. Well, that class has Hakeem. It's got Ewing.
That's true.
I think it's Barkley. It's got Barkley.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a huge class. Whole
dream team almost. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's. Does it have Stockton?
No. Ooh, good question. I haven't seen.
There's like four or five Hall of Famers.
Absolutely.
So it's a great product, and then you got the stickers that go along with it too, which also are extremely valuable.
Yeah. True.
All right, Clark. Let me set the stage here a little bit. We talked a lot about new cards, and I guess that was a perfect segue. I've got thousands of 1950s and 1960s baseball cards from my father. Wow. In the early 90s, that kid finds the Honus Wagner card in the can, right? So
yeah.
So we get the box of cards down. I'm 7, 8, maybe. And it's like, it totally engages me into the hobby, right? So I'm dialed in, but I still have these cards to this day now. These old cards. Like, obviously, my cards from the 90s are worthless. I understand that.
Right.
My son is now 7. And he literally cleaned his room yesterday. And he stacked up all his baseball cards. He's like, you want these? So he's more into Pokemon cards. Okay. So once he's gone and definitely not into it, what am I supposed to do with these thousands of cards?
Like the... You mean your son's cards, like the modern cards?
No, yeah. I mean the old ones from the 50s and 60s.
Oh, the vintage cards.
Yeah, like like logistically, what would you suggest I do with them?
That's interesting. Vintage cards definitely have some value, obviously, right? Because especially if you're looking 50s, 60s. But depending on the player, what I would do, and I get some DMs every once in a while as well from collectors that find, you know, cards from the past. And they always like ask, what should I do with this? Exact same question you're asking. I always say the same thing. eBay is the primary, right now at least, it's a primary marketplace to buy sports cards, like singles, you know? And if you want to know how much it's worth, you kind of just kind of type on their eBay search engine, you look for the card, and then you can see essentially the current market value, because there will be some that have already listed probably the card that you have.
Yeah.
So it is kind of laborious. You kind of have to go through the set, but you can know which ones are the better players, like in terms of name recognition.
Sure.
With those. And then you see if some of them, you find out that they're valuable. And I'm sure it's not graded or anything. It's not in the slab, right?
Right, of course.
So yeah, so you can see, I mean, this is the next big thing. Once you look at it, once you kind of see what the current market value of some of your vintage cards are, you look at the condition. If it's in pretty good shape, PSA is probably the main grader that everyone goes to because it has the most value if it grades well.
Okay.
And yeah, if you see like, and vintage cards different because it doesn't have to be a PSA 10, which is the gem mint condition for, and that's what you get for the modern cards. But for vintage cards, some like a Jackie Robinson Leaf 1948, a PSA 2 costs over 10 grand, right?
Okay.
Like, you could get a really beat up card, but because it's Jackie Robinson, because it's a vintage card, you don't expect a lot of these cards to be in great condition because they're so old.
Yeah.
So
interesting.
You can look at it and say that maybe I search, this might be a PSA 3 just because the corners are rounded. You know, maybe I dropped the card a few times. and then you kind of see what it's worth. And maybe that's a card you might consider submitting to PSA or Beckett, whatever grading card company you prefer. And then, you know, you got something that's worth something. So
yeah,
that's what I would suggest.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.
So you've mentioned before on your podcast, and I think anyone who's kind of even casually familiar with trading cards knows the term the junk era of trading cards. I believe junk it represent like the late 90s essentially.
Yeah.
Area
when we collected. Yeah.
Yeah. When we collected. How right. Are there more distinct eras of trading card collectibles associated with the hobby, or is it pretty consistent outside that one era in terms of interest, types, collectability, those sorts of things?
Yeah, and I think the junk wax era we know really well because that's when we collected as kids. That's when card companies over-manufactured, over-printed cards to the moon. And that's why it's worth absolutely nothing these days, right? But the only thing that's comparable more recently now is something called the junk slab era, okay? And that's when all of us 30, 40 somethings got back into the hobby. We're like, whoa, these are worth something now, you know, during pandemic. And we're submitting cards by the hundreds to these grading companies. So now you got lots of slabs, which is just a short for graded cards that are encapsulated by these grading companies. And you know, you pretty much sent anything, base cards, you know, not even rare cards. You just submitted it to PSA because if it gets a 10, then you get a bump in value and then you're just flipping. But like I mentioned earlier in the show, everything's kind of corrected itself. So all those base cards that you sent to PSA, they're pretty much worth nothing now too, because nobody wants them. So we're kind of in this junk slab era where there's a bunch of slabs absolutely worth nothing. You might go to a local card show, you'll probably see some of them still around. You're like, oh, that's the sucker that submitted something at the wrong time and got the cards back, you know, way too late, and now they're stuck with it. But it's similar that way. Yeah,
I've got two comments on that. One, I have a large box of a PSA submission that probably has 300 cards in it that I haven't even opened yet. Right. I got it back probably 3 years ago.
Okay.
I don't even know what cards are in it. I have no idea what I sent. I just remember getting it because I have so many slabs. It's ridiculous. I was just like, I can't open this up and look at these cards and figure out what I have and put them all on eBay. It just got so overwhelming for me where I just sent so much stuff off and got so much back. But I was able to, I made quite a bit of money doing exactly what you were saying. And even though I have a lot of slabs left, I was really careful about what I sent to PSA.
Smart. Yeah.
And even though my sale, I mean, I took most of my stuff off eBay just because I got tired of shipping something every single day. But I think there's so many ways to make money still in this hobby, even though that time period has passed us from the pandemic.
Right.
So I just think you just have to be really more diligent in your research and what you buy and what you send in.
Sure.
Yeah. Agreed. You definitely have to do more research. That's for sure. Now, and you know, I agree with you. People still do the dollar box. If you go to the card store, you could go through essentially what you did with going online and look at the back shops. There's a lot of these dollar boxes where people go through each one. You never know which gems you're going to find, but if you know what you're looking for, if you know what the limited edition cards are or the top rookies, there's definitely a play to be had for sure. I agree.
So let me ask about the PSA process. First of all, for those who are primarily unaware, the entire conversation around PSA centers around getting your trading cards, sending it off to a company. The most popular one is PSA. Mm-hmm. They then grade the card on a scale of, what is it, go to zero or is it 1 to 10? I don't know.
1 to 10.
One to 10 scale.
Yep.
And then they send it back to you. And depending on how positive, how high your grade is, the value of the card increases. And so really what you were hunting and what you guys are talking about is that perfectly graded PSA 10 graded card, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So I had heard throughout the pandemic that people like Kurt here doing that exact tactic backed them up to an extreme degree where people were submitting cards and then not getting them back for extremely long time periods.
Oh,
have they caught up?
They're caught up.
They are caught up.
But that time period was brutal. I had to wait over a year for some of my cards to come back.
Oh my God, how stressful.
They come back after. It's like, by the time it comes back, the car prices have come all the way back down. So you're like, oh, what am I going to do with them, right? So
that's why that box is sitting up there, is because it took 17 months to get it back from PSA.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was crazy.
I've heard stories like that for sure.
We'll have to do an unboxing video.
Yeah, we should. I have no idea what's in it.
Tell me when you do. I'll watch. But they are caught up because the PSA... I can't remember when exactly, 3 or 4 years ago, it was bought out by another bigger corporation. So they cleaned things up, the process and everything, tried to clear all the backlog. That took about a year and a half. And they actually, at one point, stopped receiving submissions just to catch up on their backlog. So that was a risky business move. Like you're saying, no, I don't want to take any more money. I want to catch up on the operation side of things. So it worked out for PSA, but they're pretty much caught up. And now they have different tiers. If you want your card faster, like express or super express service, you pay more for that. So you could pay $100 to grade one card if you want it, like within 7-14 days kind of thing, if you want it that fast. Yeah.
That's if you pull a Wembanyama
a big
parallel card. Autograph card.
The no auto.
You auto. Yeah, you send it FedEx overnight.
I would just drive it there. Like, what time do you guys open?
Yeah. And then you pay it for immediate grade back so that you get it back in 3 or 4 days.
Gotcha.
And it might cost you $300-$400 total, but it's totally worth it when you have a card that could be worth
change your life
tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah,
exactly.
Clark, I currently have 3 children, 7, mm-hmm. 5, and 2, and they're the ones okay. who have really brought me back into this hobby. You've mentioned, I think, on the podcast that you've been exploring the hobby with your own kids. Do you have any advice, tips, anything along those lines for maximizing the entertainment of the hobby with them?
Yeah. Well, I have a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old, both boys, and the 3-year-old, he's too young. He looks at my cards and then he chucks it across the room. So he's not ready for card collecting yet. But my 6-year-old's totally into it. Like, I don't know. It's different for everyone, I guess. But for us, he likes the sports that I watch. So I watch a lot of baseball. I watch a lot of basketball. And he's really like, he's already like a stats geek, right? So you got the stats behind the cards. So, you know, a lot of it is collecting product that's, you know, you could find some of your hometown team guys, and it's kind of fun for them to rip open packs and see, it's a Toronto Blue Jays, or we're in Canada, so we collect hockey cards as well too, right? Maple Leafs, you know, so that's one way of doing it. And, you know, kids nowadays are really savvy too. You know, like if you go to card shows, it's not uncommon to see 10-year-old, 11-year-old kids hustling, going from booth to booth, trying to flip their cards, you know? So they're already learning real fast. You know, they're already used to being online and researching which cards are worth something, right? So, and it's kind of fun to open like a, you know, Topps 2024 Topps Series 1 just came out, which is about $90 USD. So it's not that much to get a hobby box. You can go through 24 packs really quickly, but they know what the hits are too. Like a lot of the shiny cards, you know, it's kind of fun to get that hit from the box, or whether it's an autograph card. It's kind of cool to see, you know, them pull an autograph card. So just kind of ripping packs open together, it's kind of a fun thing. And you know, I think one of you guys mentioned Pokemon cards. Yeah. It's kind of an easy transition too, right? Like my kid loves Pokemon cards as well. So there's the holos in that, and you know, anything shiny is kind of cool to find in packs. So that's usually a hit. So, you know, ripping cards open, always a good time. And yeah, any questions they have about like whether they're into the sport or just even the sports card, the case hit or the box hit, it's kind of fun doing it together.
Yeah.
So
I love what you said about, like, you know, what a great skill to teach such a young age, interpreting a market, understanding a market, the economics behind it, and just like, you know, understanding the value of anything, that the perception of the value, and like starting to get a grasp on that. Like, what a great skill to grow into.
How about negotiating?
Yeah, negotiating.
Talking to strangers.
Yeah, totally.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's good stuff. I like it. I'm going to keep pushing kids, Max, but I don't think he's going to get into it.
Well, you should take him to a show.
I should. Yeah, that would be fun.
And then you guys can walk around and see all the different cards they got in there.
We'll get a good juju booth.
Yeah, we'll go. Let's do it.
Yeah, and you know what? These kids, they're just fearless. Like, you know, in our adult age, you know, we don't want to be rejected. We go to booths and we're like, hey, do you want to buy? And then, you know, a lot of these booth owners are like, or shop owners are like, no, not interested. And you just kind of go on to the next one. You hang your head low. Some of these kids, they're just like, hey, do you want this? No. All right. Right. Next booth. They ask the exact same question. They're just like, you know, they're all business. It's kind of cool to see that they love doing, you know, hustling that way. So.
Do you have any preferred brands, or are there what how many are there right now, major manufacturers of trading cards?
Yeah. I guess it's different for different sports, and things are kind of in flux too, because there's licensing agreements, and like I mentioned, Fanatics bought Topps out, which Topps was an institution. If you collect the baseball cards, you know about Topps baseball, around for decades. And there's this old legacy company that just kind of like didn't really innovate. You know, they're just kind of like, oh, we're kind of a monopoly. And then Fanatics comes along and takes the MLB license, and then they buy Topps for $500 million, I believe was the evaluation, right? So Fanatics owns Topps, which is the primary baseball brand, and under the Topps brand there's a lot of like these smaller products, right? So Bowman Chrome is kind of part of the Topps umbrella, you know, that you're talking about. So it's kind of these different sub brands, but they're all part of the bigger Topps brand. basketball, you got your Panini Prism, which is a big basketball card set. But then they're about to lose their NBA license, and then Fanatics will own that license as well. So,
oh wow,
the big talk in the hobby right now is Fanatics is kind of becoming a monopoly. You know, there's people that love Fanatics, people that think that's a bad idea. But yeah, so depending on the sport, Panini Prism is also big in football as well. So yeah, Donruss is still around. Donruss doesn't have the Players Association, the league license. So that's why you'll see some of those cards without the team logos on it. So there's that to consider as well.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
My mind has been blown since the moment you started talking, Clark, because I did not know that Bowman and Topps Chrome were not like rivals competing with each other for the dominance of the baseball market, which is the way I've always viewed that in my head. They're the same company?
Yes.
Were they always the same company?
Yes.
Like since like the 50s?
Like Topps, Bowman is just a product line of Topps from day one.
For a while. I think Bowman might have been its own thing for like in the past.
But yeah.
It came under the Topps umbrella pretty
wild.
Yeah.
The more you know, that's why we're here, to teach people.
I believe that's the case. Yeah.
We're talking about Fanatics, right? So we're going to nerd out a little bit. Fanatics bought Topps in 2022, and that what they're going to start production in 2026, somewhere around there, 2025. I saw that they're in a lawsuit with Panini. What is that about? Is that basically about the monopoly?
Pretty much. And I believe it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just going back and forth, kind of lost track because they're suing each other. There's countersuits. And there's just a legal mess right now. But yeah, it's kind of the last I heard, you know, Panini accused Fanatics of poaching their employees. So they've got some VPs that went crossed over. They're like, hey, you know, you're stealing some of our executives to come to our company. And then, you know, they bought out the printer that produces both the Topps and Panini cards. And they're like, you're stifling competition. So that's part of the suit, I believe, as well. So Fanatics is doing everything in terms of, I guess some people say it's smart business moves, but really Panini's coming to the point where it's like they're running out of options. And they lost their license to Fanatics as well, you know, in terms of the major league, the different league licenses as well. So soon, even Panini Prism basketball and football, you're mentioning, right? They have the team logos, but in 25, 26, if they want to still produce football and basketball cards, they'll be in the position where they can only produce the players without the team logos as well.
That's
so
right.
Now they're like, oh, what do we do? Right. So yeah.
Fanatics has those NBA and NFL license coming up.
Yes. In a couple of years.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I wasn't clear on that. I wasn't sure, like, before they bought that, I thought they were going to buy Panini out.
Well, that's the play. That's what they did with Topps, right?
Yeah, I thought Fanatics was going to end up buying Panini and just keeping the license in their name and, you know, continue on, right?
But it's the same.
But it sounds like they just bought the license. They're just going to move Panini out of the business completely or turn them into Sage or, you know, Leaf or something like that.
Right. They'll have to pivot for sure. I heard the same. Yeah, there was always rumors and rumblings about Fanatics looking to buy out Panini. And then we're, you know, even on one of our podcast episodes, we're saying, oh, is this the week that they do it? And then next thing you know, they're suing each other. So I guess the negotiation didn't work out that well behind the scenes.
Clark, do you pay attention to the sports gambling world at all? Or are you strictly over in your space?
A little bit. I mean, I was into DFS, like fantasy, daily fantasy. That's kind of what I'm into,
I bring that up because we faced the exact same conversation with DraftKings and Fanatics. An employee is leaving DraftKings.
Taking executives.
And he took a bunch of trade secrets with him, and he had this whole plot to hurt DraftKings via his exit, and he was heading to Fanatics too, right?
Right, totally, yeah.
So
what happened with that?
DraftKings is pressed criminal charges against the employee. And I think all that has to play out before anything else plays out in that space. But it sounds like what you're saying from the trading card experience and what we see over on the sports gambling side of things from a Fanatics perspective, very similar tactics being taken.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to read about that story. When did that come out?
Like last week.
Like last week. Look, that you remember that? Yeah. I got that right, right?
Yeah, totally. Because Fanatics has a sports book. I don't know if you're hip to that, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I know they're getting to the sports betting space as well. Yeah,
for sure. And then they own the teams and then the stadiums. And then that'll be that.
Did they start as a clothing line?
Yeah.
Just a marketplace.
Yes. Yes. They started doing the jerseys and clothes and things like that.
Yeah.
So with Fanatics basically taking over, you know, I know the major concern when I was really deep the past 4 years was this talk about print run. So, and that seems to be a major concern within the hobby. Now that Fanatics is going to move with the MLB tops, and then they're going to have the NBA and NFL license, are they going to finally address the print run issue that so many collectors and investors, you know, have problems with?
That's the $1 million question, right? It's kind of, for me, I feel like right now, at least, because you don't know how things are going to ultimately play out, but Michael Rubin, who's the CEO of Fanatics, on our podcast, we're pretty big fans of Michael Rubin, like what he's done so far. So there's that kind of maybe the initial trust factor in believing that he won't go crazy with print runs and over manufacture. You know, we don't want to see another junk wax era 2.0, you know, in our day and age. But that's something to definitely watch out for. And so far, there's no signs that it looks like he's going to make the hobby, you know, a junk wax era 2.0 in terms of overprinting. But you never know, right? With companies that do act like a monopoly, that's one of those things where I think Michael Rubin himself in one of the articles mentioned that why he thinks the lawsuit from Panini is frivolous is because they did the exact same thing when they were essentially a monopoly, where they own the basketball, football card market. They overprinted everything. They made lots of money. And now that some other company is doing exactly what they did 10, 15 years ago, you know, he's saying now Panini's crying and pointing the finger at what they did. You know, so that's pretty much their case, right? And so, you know, from all the interviews I've heard from Michael Rubin and about Fanatics, it looks like they're trying to do things a little differently. Maybe I'm just being overly optimistic, but, you know, they're coming up with different innovations, different subsets, different limited series. You hope that's going to be something that they're more into rather than let's print things to the moon. But again, you never know. One thing, you know, companies, I think we talked about this last week or a couple of weeks ago on our pods, like when you have that much power, greed does funny things, right? You're like, maybe we can print a few million more copies and no one will notice. And then, you know, collectors notice. Ultimately, they notice. Yeah. So
are you more bearish or bullish on the market moving forward?
I'm definitely more bullish. Yeah. Okay. I think, I don't know. I think I have to be if I wanted to be in this hobby and I want things to continue. I kind of transitioned into, I'm lucky enough to do this more full time as well. Right. So more hopeful and optimistic. But I do believe when he says things like, going back to Michael Rubin, he wants to 10X the hobby. I know people make fun of him for saying that, but what does 10X the hobby look like? And that for me, looks like you still have to bring in more collectors to the space, more hobbyists, get people in the mainstream more interested. And not just the four of us here, 40 somethings, you know, coming back to the hobby. You need to get that next generation into the space. So I think that's their intention. And, you know, Michael Rubin has a lot of celebrity friends. I don't know if you saw the latest kind of marketing campaign that he did, but on the top series one, there's a special limited set. It was kind of a secret. But people started to rip open packs. And you guys know Kevin Hart, the comedian?
Oh, sure.
He's from Philadelphia. And in the top series one, there's a limited series set that's numbered to 52, right? And in these cards, these parallels, there's a small miniature version of Kevin Hart on these cards. So it's numbered to 52. And it's numbered to 52 because the joke is that he's 5'2". So they only made 52 of these cards. And it's only printed on the Philadelphia Phillies cards because he's from Philadelphia. So they're doing things like that are fun. And there was a campaign where he FaceTimed Kevin Hart And Kevin Hart pretended to be upset about these cards. he's like, I thought I was going to have my own baseball card. And then it turned out to be a miniature version of him making fun of him. So I think these are creative solutions to making the hobby more fun and more accessible to guys and you know, men and women outside of the hobby, or people that are not normally into sports cards. They know Kevin Hart. Maybe they start dabbling into, like, you know, baseball cards just because they're fans of the comedian rather than baseball cards. Yeah.
And that's a really good example, I think, because that's an example of something that slipped over into the mainstream where I saw that news. So yeah, I was actually familiar with that, and it's not because I'm paying attention to your hobby.
Yeah. Nice. It's working. It's working that way for sure.
Why does the season start so far before meaningful packs of trading cards related to that season come out? Let me give you an example. We were looking for Victor Wembanyama rookie cards prior to the Christmas holiday, and we would go to our local trading card store, and the only thing they had was NBA hoops. The season started in October. Where are all the ones that aren't NBA hoops at that point in the season?
I don't know about the NBA. I feel like NBA hoops is usually the first product that comes out every season, right? Like, they're the first ones to drop. And I don't know if they've always come out, you know, a few months before the season started. Maybe that's the scheduling of you know, that particular product. But yeah.
Hoops always comes out first.
But why don't they release when the season starts? Why can't we get pictures, NBA trading cards? Is there a reason behind why it takes so far into the season for them to start dropping their releases?
Yeah, because they've got so many sets, and it's all done in order by date. So they release them as separate out. You know, they don't want to pile on the entire
release market. Them all at once.
Yeah, all the sets,
and it's all one company.
Right. So it's kind of like it's kind of like a slow burn, and I think Prism First of the Line just came out this week, right?
Yeah.
For NBA.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So you're going to start to see a lot of Prism stuff go out. And I think Select will come out next.
And the pandemic kind of messed with the schedule as well. So that's why I was wondering if the schedule's back on track now. But I do remember Hoops being always the first one to come out for sure.
I get it. These are all the same brand, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. It's one company. They're not going to release their own competition on the first day.
No, I was like, why is NBA Hoops the only one releasing? Only one? Yeah, right. Where's Panini?
Panini owns Hoops.
Right. It's all one company.
This is the source of my confusion about the hobby overall that we're clearing up right now, Clark. This is good stuff.
It's like you met the wizard.
I was so confused by you guys all looking at me like I'm asking a dumb question when I think I'm asking a fantastic question.
Yeah.
And I realize it's because I think these are all still companies competing against each other.
Yeah, nope.
Okay, moving on. You ask a better question.
Cut that.
There is no competition in NFL and NBA trading cards.
Yeah, got it.
Or baseball.
Right, none of them, right?
unless you like to buy guys without their jersey numbers or names on the back.
Wearing their polos.
On the back of their baseball card.
We say they're in their pajamas, the ones without the logos.
Right.
The team color.
So let's get into something that I really love and really enjoyed. I don't do it as often anymore, but I loved participating in card breaking. That was one of my favorite things to do. And for anybody who doesn't know what card breaking is essentially you could go to a card breaker's website or you could go on eBay. Right. And you could, for whatever product you wanted to, because these products are so expensive, right? Packs of cards cost so much money.
Okay.
So you could go look for the set, whichever set you want. Like, say you wanted to do Panini Prism. Like, say you wanted to try to get a Jason Tatum rookie card of Panini Prism.
Okay.
So you would go and search for the 2017 Panini Prism, right? And you could get into a break where you could buy the Celtics team. So you would get all the players of the Celtics from that box.
Okay.
Right. And they do it many different ways. For some of the baseball sets, you can buy players. And like I said, you can do teams.
Okay.
So what you would do is you would then go purchase that team or player. Right. And then you would tune into the show and you would watch the breaker open the packs live.
Like a bunch of packs, not one pack.
a bunch of packs.
Yeah, okay.
Right?
How tracking.
Sometimes they open as much as a case.
Yeah.
It might be yeah, okay. two boxes, right? So you get it.
And I'm watching him hoping he does the Jason Tatum because I bought the rights to the Celtics.
Yes.
Okay, got it.
And then any card that you hit is yours.
He's going to put it in the mail and send it to me.
And he's going to put it in the mail and send it to you.
Okay.
Yep.
Now, lately, we've seen a lot of scammers.
I was like, seems ripe for scams.
Ripe for scams. And I'm in. There's so many examples of this all over YouTube.
Yeah.
Can you update us on the card breaking side of the industry? And has that trust returned, or is it still kind of damaged over what has happened with previous scamming?
Yeah, really good question. I think there's more confidence in it because I feel like some of those measures has been taken by the bigger breaking companies, right? So the more research you do, you realize, oh, these breakers are reputable. So a lot of them, it kind of consolidates to the top, right? So it is harder for smaller breakers to get started because, you know, you got to build credibility. And when it was booming, to your point, Kurt, like everyone was trying to break, get a product, and then it's like, hey, buy into my break. And then you see them live, and then you see silly shenanigans. Like when you're breaking live, you don't want to see the card go off the screen and then come back in, and then you're like, well, what happened there, you know? And it's like, and then that's why I joke I will be a horrible breaker, because I do that non-purposely. Like I right. Their hands start to wander, and I'm like, oh shoot, wait, it just looks fishy when I do it. But I don't break for anyone except myself. But but back in the day, there were so many guys breaking in their own room, and people were like just desperate to get any product. So obviously in that COVID era, it was a right time to scam a bunch of people. But now that things have settled down, the more serious players like Layton, we were talking about Fanatics, they launched something called Fanatics Live, which is their own breaking platform.
Oh my gosh.
So they're obviously wow. legit. Yeah. So they're into that space as well. Fanatics Live is, they get other breakers that want to use their platform, but the conditions for them are much more strict. Like you need, I think you need at least 3 cameras to operate. If you don't have it, you can't break on their platform. So they want to make that security there, because you want to give the person buying into the breaks, you know, different camera angles. You could see exactly what the cards are open, you know, that are being opened. You could replay it later. And so they're definitely serious about security. And there are other breakers that are doing the exact same thing. So yeah, it's a fun way to break, to get into bigger, more expensive products. I have zero luck. I don't break a lot, but I've broken in the past. It's perfect for your pocket. It is a form of gambling.
Yeah, it totally is. I mean, the allure is you pay, you basically, you're going to bid on a team.
Yeah.
It's like open market.
Mm-hmm.
So that way, the guy that owns the cards is going to make more money than he has into it, because that's
fascinating. You know, like, up over the cost.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
But if you want to buy, like, hey, I want a Wembanyama, right?
Yeah.
Then you got to buy the San Antonio Spurs. It's probably 5x more than the Raptors team.
Because, right. Because it's a free market.
A rookies. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
That's what I like about it. Yeah.
But there you go. Yeah. With how expensive product has become, is breaking really as popular as it was back then? Because I can't buy some hobby boxes. I mean, they're just too expensive. I can't pay $1,200 for a hobby box. Do you think that the prices of some of these products are still keeping people out of participating in breaks?
Yeah, I think at some point when it's too expensive, it will come down. Like I believe in the market dynamics, but I also believe we'll always have gamblers. So I don't think that you have to worry about breaking not being a thing, because there's a lot of degens out there that love to gamble, and you know, every once in a while that's me too. I'm like, yeah, let's live a little. Let's go for it. and so one of my co-hosts, he's a way bigger breaker than I am, or into breaking than I am, and it's yeah. Sometimes you really do well. Like if you're into J-Rod for baseball, Mariners, always a great pick, and then depending on the product itself too, right? There could be other rookies in that set, that whatever team that you bought, it could be worth your while. But it is fun for me. I see it as a form of entertainment, kind of like gambling. It's for me, it's entertainment. You know what I mean? Like there's a little risk involved, and there could be big rewards. But you know, if you don't get anything, it was fun while it lasted.
Do you collect any other forms of sports memorabilia, or is it exclusively trading cards?
Let me see. Do I have anything else? I think, it's pretty much 99.9% trading cards. Yeah.
Is there a market? So can you break down for us real quickly in terms of collectors who are collecting more historical items that seem to continue to increase in value versus individuals who are investing in recent items and like new releases and stuff? Because it seems like that's two very different distinct groups, is it not?
I think so. Yeah, I think you're right. You know, if you go on Golden Auctions, Ken Golden's a big player in the hobby. He runs an online auction house. I've sent some of my stuff to him to sell some of my bigger cards, but they're also into the memorabilia space too. So like anything from photos, autographed photos, to helmets, to gloves, anything, it's up there. But I think the people that go visit that part of the auction page on their website I think it's different than like I rarely go over to that page. I'm always onto the trading card or things, and I feel like it's vice versa, it's the same way as well. Yeah, I think it's a different group.
It's got to be more high roller, right? Because they're auctioning like Jordan game worn Jordan stuff and things,
jerseys.
Like that. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's, I think so.
That's an aspect of the hobby that I do find intriguing, where you're owning a real piece of history that is never going to be able to be replicated because it's a moment in time that you own.
And yeah.
That's occurring now in trading cards as well, correct? Is that what relics are? I've listened to your podcast and I'm very intrigued because I saw an article about Ellie De La Cruz's bases when he stole a bunch of bases getting turned into trading cards. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know what? Funny enough, relic cards aren't as valuable. Like there's not that respect for relic cards compared to like autograph cards. And now, you know, you have both, like you can have a relic autograph card, right? So relic can be anything from a patch of the jersey, you know, they cut up the jersey and embed it into the card. Some of the crazier ones are like actual pieces of shoe. Like you see the laces of the shoe and the cards are like this thick if you ever pull one, because they got to embed that shoe in the card. And, you know, like, you know, any other clothing, leather. I had a leather glove, piece of a leather glove one. That was kind of cool as well. And the bases you were mentioning too. So yeah, but for some reason, if it's just a relic card on the store, and then there's like distinctions, right? Is it game used? Did the person, did the player wear it in a particular game? Or is it player worn, which is like, the joke is like, oh, they put it on and they took it off and then top just, you know, cut it up. And that's, it qualifies as a player worn jersey, you know, it has no attachment to any game that they've played, right? So there's different kind of categories of relic cards as well. So you got to definitely do your research there.
If that's an area, if I'm looking to get into it as a collector more than as a investor, that sounds like that's a more affordable or at least a better value than chasing autographs, correct?
Yep. I think that's generally true. Yeah.
I find fascinating the idea that you're owning a piece of history in your hand. I mean, an autograph's cool, but you know, that guy's signing thousands of those.
Yeah. But that's kind of what he's saying.
So you actually own
the
piece of history.
Well, the guy puts the shirt on, takes it off and they cut it up and he does that 50,000 times.
Yeah.
That's kind of what he's saying.
Yeah.
So you want to find the distinction between player worn relics and game used. Like, so look for the game used ones. Those are generally tend to be more valuable. I actually Fanatics is doing a better job now that they're, even the relic cards, they're trying to make it more game used instead of player worn, because there's such a negative stigma to that, obviously, because they're, you know, cheaping out. But I just pulled a relic card of Spencer Torkelson of the Tigers, and it's a bat relic. So it's a piece of a bat and it's game used. So he used it in one of the games. Kind of a cool card, but like I said, it's worth $5. So relic cards are still not that valuable.
I'm
but
in.
It's cool. You're right. A collector. Yeah. Yeah. But there you go.
But Spencer Torkelson's PSA 10 orange refractor numbered to 25 Bowman Chrome auto is probably worth $600-$700, I would imagine.
I'm out on that.
Yeah.
It's more, way more. Yeah.
Way more than that.
That was way too many words.
Yeah.
It's like ordering a Starbucks coffee. You got to know the modifier.
So that's the problem, Clark. I pulled this card with my son, and it's autographed by this prospect for the Padres. And it took me 24 hours to figure out that it was actually more special than this other autograph card I had, because this one was pink tinted and had number to 199 on it. There's a lot. There's a lot going on there.
A lot to know.
There's sticker autos and on card autos. We didn't even go there, but you want the on card autos, the ones that the players held the cards to sign. Not the stickers that, a lot of them sign stickers. And then what the manufacturer will do, will take that sticker and put it on the card. So it's
sneaky.
Never touch the cards.
I got a sticker.
So that's your Bowman Platinum, right?
Oh.
That's the one that's Manuel Beltre.
Yep.
Yeah.
A sticker.
Put it in your bike.
Bowman Platinum does the sticker autos.
Yeah. You want the on-card autos if you can.
Yeah. All right, guys. Is there anything else before we wrap up?
Yeah. I'm doing this rap.
Let's do it.
Yep. I'm going to do
rapid fire.
I'm going to do a rapid fire with
you. Love it.
Okay. So I got five questions for you. Okay. Let's start with number one. Favorite grading company slab, all things included, look, value that you get in return, and the accuracy of the grading company. PSA, Beckett, or SGA? What you going with?
Oh, man. If you're a podcast listener, you know I'll say Beckett. I love Beckett. I'm old school like that. BGS. But PSA still delivers the most value. So it's a love-hate relationship with PSA. But a lot of my slabs that I own are in Beckett slabs. So I got to go with Beckett.
All right. Favorite hobby product?
Baseball card collector. So first, the Bowman Chrome every year. Bowman
Chrome.
I love it.
Okay.
Prospecting, now, yeah.
I'm going to throw you a curve on this one. Favorite retail product?
Ooh. Favorite retail. Topps Heritage.
Topps Heritage.
I love going... Blaster boxes. I don't like to buy the hobby boxes because it's usually not a good ROI, but I love the look and feel of the heritage cards, like, old school cardboard. So I'll go to get a cheap retail box for $40 or so. Yeah.
Very quick for our audience. The difference between a retail and a hobby box, Clark, is?
So retail, if you go to Walmart or Target, you got those like smaller boxes that have like maybe 7 or 8 packs.
Oh.
Usually they don't have the big hits. Hobby boxes you usually get from like your local card shop, and they have more packs in the box. Usually they the hobby boxes guarantee an autograph card or a relic card, whereas the blasters, the retail boxes, there's no guarantee of getting anything, but it is definitely cheaper to get retail. Yeah.
All right. This is a big one now. I know who you're going to pick. Pick one to invest in, Wembanyama or Ohtani.
Oh. Gotta be Shohei Ohtani.
I knew it.
100%.
I knew it.
100%. Yeah.
Do I agree? That's a great question. I mean,
never mind.
Sorry, we asked.
That'll take me 20 minutes.
Only one of those guys is getting paid $700 million. Okay.
I agree with that. So I'll go with Ohtani with you. All right. How about this one? And our last rapid fire question, your holy grail card.
Oh, I just bought it this past year. Mike Trout first Bowman Chrome Auto. It was the card I always wanted as a baseball fan. I'm hoping Mike Trout stays healthy. Fingers crossed. But yeah, that card was again in over 20,000 at the peak during the hobby, and I was able to get it for about $4,000 or $5,000. So I was really happy with that.
Wow! Is it graded?
Yep, BGS 9 Beckett.
That's pretty good. What's the auto on it?
Auto's 10, yeah. I always go for auto 10s on those, yeah.
Nice. Well, congratulations on getting your Holy Grail card.
Thank you.
Appreciate that's a big accomplishment. Not everybody can do that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Definitely you couldn't do that during the peak COVID area because everything was tens of thousands of dollars. But now's the time to buy, guys. Now's the time to buy.
I'm just going to go talk to my accountant and see how many baseball cards I can buy. And then I'm going to open them up on the internet and keep all the money.
Clark, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. You can find all of Clark's content at 5cardguys.com. Clark, is there anything you'd like to plug while you're on with us?
No, you did a great job. 5cardguys, mostly active on Instagram at 5cardguys. We post a bunch of stuff every day. And like you already mentioned, if a lot of things I talk, this is exactly how I talk with you guys, with my co-hosts, about different parts of the hobby, sports cards, what's trending. Even your rapid fire about pick one, we do that weekly. Like, which one would you rather invest in, this card or that card? And, you know, it's always fun to debate those things. And that's on Cards to the Moon. You can listen to it wherever you listen to your podcast. We come out every Tuesday and every other Friday. Yeah, so appreciate that plug. And yeah, lots of fun, guys. I had a blast.
Really appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Clark. It was awesome to talk to you.
Have a good one.
Hey, thanks for listening to Cards to the Moon. We'd really appreciate you subscribing to our podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can also connect with each of us on Instagram at 5cardguys, or you can follow Hyung at Integrity Sports Cards, or John at TradeU at Recess. You can also check us out at 5cardguys.com. Thanks again, and hope to connect soon.